it's Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. Guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
All right, welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast podcasted weekly from a kitchen bench in Kingsland, Auckland, New Zealand. My name's Lewis, and this one's going out a little late. Weekly being technically missed last week, though this is very early Monday morning. I'm putting this beautiful attachment thing on the front of the conversation. So I'll try and catch up, chuck another one up this week. But hey, it's a hobby, and sometimes things that aren't hobbies in life take precedence, like marking nearly 50 essays that essentially say the same thing over and over and over, that you have to comment on and make suggestions on over and 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 over. I went to the Coromandel this weekend. That was lovely. Caught one tiny fish, no, three actually, but one that I kept, and I'm going to eat that. It's very good. My guest this week is probably one of the people I've known longest outside of my family, which is interesting in itself, isn't it? Yes, it is. Mr. David Lawrence, well known in the theatre, the thespian, the actorial, the stage directorial community in New Zealand, has just moved up here because he's essentially been living here, up here being Auckland, for 18 months, working on the pop-up globe. We talk a bit about that. It's actually just a lot of reminiscence about our younger years. So hopefully you can relate, even if you don't know the people or the places. Nostalgia and school and so on, a powerful thing, methinks, a universal thing. Join us for the highs and lows of being anywhere between 5 and about 18. Death features prominently in this episode. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because it's too... Are we middle-aged? I get the fear when people say people my age are middle-aged, but maybe two middle-aged men meeting up to talk about their past are on some subconscious level thinking about the future. But seriously, rest in peace, Mr. Andrew Menzies, our dear friend. Without further ado, enjoy.
This is Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs.
Hey, well, I think we've started, so I better say who you are and why you're here. Uh-huh. Well, you're here because it's the podcast, obviously.
Hooray.
Episode number 27.
27.
Trying to get up to 52 and then decide what to do then. So it used to be, I used to say on the website there's one up every Tuesday, but I've been so busy that I erased that the other day. So thank you, because we're going to get in to one a week, because it's going to be up by today, which is Sunday. Not that that's here nor there to you if you're listening, because it could be any time in the world, anywhere. It could be 2043. And you could be listening to this on some old computing device. My guest today is an award. I didn't write much for you. It's very hard. We'll speak about your name in a second. An award win. You know what I'm going to say,
my
right?
My low virtual footprint, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I better rush. Award-winning director, actor, and teacher, founder of...
The Bacchanals.
Attendee of the Globe, receiver of the Globe International Actors Fellowship, which I'm assuming means you attended something.
Participants, and they do an International Actors Fellowship every second year, and I did that in 2013.
And where did you go?
Well, that's like a bunch of actors from all over the world. Wow. Go to Shakespeare's Globe in London and spend some time hanging out, rehearsing, having classes and workshops, and sort of shared international cultural practice.
Wait.
Yeah.
And as a Hunter Fellow, Victoria University of Wellington, which I'll also ask about.
I'm the only one that isn't like a rich old white man. I'm still a white man. But
And relating to having just moved on up here permanently, has been obviously in denial that he in fact has a full-time job up here as head of production and research type fellow for the Pop-Up Globe Auckland. Welcome, David Lawrence.
Hi.
If you Google David Lawrence Wellington, you get news about how the retail chain has folded. If you Google the regular David Lawrence with no addition, you get the retail chain David Lawrence. If you Google David Lawrence actor, you get a guy based in the US.
Oh, yes, yes.
If you Google David Lawrence director, you get some other things. But then you're not much of a... You're not much of an internet footprint kind of fellow, are you? You're
no.
not a Facebooker.
Twitter and Instagram, but no, not Facebook.
Mm. So you had that. You had that quite anti Facebook T-shirt on one of the last times I saw you.
Yes.
But then you're on Twitter, so I'm not sticking up for social media in general. It's sort of a blessing and a scourge. But why the seething hatred of Facebook and the endorsement of Twitter?
I think of Twitter as being an instant news feed. I think Facebook is social media. I think Twitter is social media.
What does that mean?
That it's an instant... I'm not under any illusions that all of the people that I follow or that follow me on Twitter I have any sort of personal connection with.
Yeah.
And, okay, some of the people, yes, I do. Some of the people are friends that I have a personal connection with.
Yeah.
But in a nutshell, I guess what I've seen as being the negative side of Facebook is the way that people believe... they've got these deep, lasting connections with somebody that they met at a bus stop or at a bar because they're friends on the social media platform.
But then you don't strike me as someone who's at all against social connection and so on.
No,
you just think it's a little contrived.
Yeah,
I think it's a great answer. I'm just pushing you to elaborate on the answer.
I'm really interested too in the way that people's social media personalities. Like I read a lot of stuff where. Where new parents think they're failing because they're having a miserable, awful time with this new human being in their lives, but everybody on Facebook is like, my baby is amazing. My baby is already walking at 6 days old. My baby can speak French. And because it's about accentuating all the positive, we're number one, life is amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, that's...
I tried to remove myself from it. I basically... occasionally just get the fear with it because I use it a lot, like most people I know now. But then I realize it's so integrated into how our lives operate now, which you're probably not aware of because you're not on it, that I actually felt like I was missing out. But maybe that's a manufactured out.
And I do get that sense because there are a lot of parties that I don't get that I don't get invited to, and people are like, oh no, you were totally invited to that. It's just you weren't on Facebook. But then when I go, well, one of the defining things about my personality is people go, oh, this is David Lawrence. He runs a theatre company and he's not on Facebook.
He's not on Facebook. Yeah, yeah.
I think it
actually takes the sheen off a lot of. The joy of kind of inviting people to stuff and so on, because I've had quite sort of generic invites. The people who've wanted me at the event, obviously, things like 40ths that I've missed, even though I'm on Facebook, because I get so many event notifications, because you and I are in one way or another from sort of an eventsy kind of a background, that I actually don't, I ignore most of those pop-ups.
Yeah.
And then I go, shit, I missed so-and-so's birthday. It was 4 weeks ago. And he or she's like, yeah, well, I invited you. And I'm like, but did you really invite me?
Yeah.
Did you just click on my name and add it to a bunch of other names? And
Now, you see, your birthday, I know that you had a Facebook event thing, but you also sent a personal email going, hey, people that might not have seen it, I'm having my birthday party and this is when it is and these are the details.
That's right. And I put a nice photo up and I went that extra mile.
Yes. Yeah.
We'll talk about this globe thing briefly, this pop-up globe. It's obviously not just a pop-up. It seems like it's one of those events that requires a lot of work, right? It's around the year operation to bring it to Auckland. How often?
How much am I allowed to say? Well, no, I can say the hope is that we will be in Auckland every year for the foreseeable future, that every summer we will do a season in a playhouse somewhere in Auckland.
And both last time, it's been twice around.
Yeah, so
times.
we've just in the last couple of weeks, we've just finished our second season.
Yeah, so it pops up generally in the middle of the CBD, but you're thinking about going all sorts of places.
Last year we were in Grays Avenue, we were in the CBD,
yeah.
And we played for 10, 11 weeks to about 90,000 people. Wow. And we've just done 13 weeks, including the extension at Ellerslie Racecourse, to 102,000 people, I think, is
wow.
the figure.
So how many is that per audience?
That's we've got a capacity of somewhere between sort of 750, 850. I think we can do 854 people per show is the maximum.
So who built said pop-up globe? Did someone obviously looked at the master, as it were, and set about...
Basically, my boss, Dr. Miles Gregory, the artistic director of the Pop-Up Globe, had a crazy idea at the start of 2015 that it might be a nice thing to do in 2016 as a one-off for the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. And being a very astute, onto it, proactive guy, he found a business partner in a school friend of his that he's known as long as you and I have known each other.
So not just a head in the clouds academic, who actually went out and, well, I'm going to get pragmatic and I'm actually going to get this done and think about it as a business.
Well, I think he basically had a catch up with his equivalent of us to each other, a guy that he'd known since he was five.
Yeah.
And that friend, Tobias Grant, who's our commercial director, that sounds like a great idea. I'm going to help you make that happen.
And these audiences seem, I mean, it seems in the world we live in, speaking of things like social media and just a barrage of kind of modern, you know, things like, something like the high octane edited Fast and Furious franchise or the modern kind of pop video or whatever, it would appear there are large audiences out there for Shakespearean plays. Are you getting, has it started off with a sort of groundswell movement of people who would go to that sort of thing typically, and now you're getting sort of anyone and everyone?
I think it maybe started out with a white-haired elitist audience.
Yeah.
but we knew that the thing that was going to break it open was the groundlings, was the people that pay, in our case, $15 or $10 or $1 for some shows this season to stand in the yard. You know, you can have about 350 people standing in the yard in amongst the action. And it's much more like a gig than it is a play.
So you get, can they buy bags of old fruit and vegetables like back
not,
in the...
No, not yet. never, hopefully.
Am I making the right cultural reference there? I believe that people used to stand in the yard would...
We've got all sorts of opinions on what the behaviour in the yard was like, but I...
Do you mean there's no written history of what audiences were doing?
Yeah, people go, audiences were rowdy and disrespectful, and then we go, well, no, actually, all the evidence suggests that maybe they were really attentive listeners. And what we've found is, so the atmosphere in the yard is like you're in the mosh pit at a gig, not in terms of people stage diving and going crazy, but it's like it is a much more alive and engaged audience than just a bunch of people sitting in the dark in comfortable seating, having an experience in isolation. It's exactly the sort of theatre that I've been trying to create for the last 20 years where everybody feels like they are...
It's inclusive.
You are in the same room as these people on this night, and no two shows are the same. Not that you're sort of generating a product that is the same every night, regardless of who's there. But every single performance is unique.
I mean, obviously, accounts of anything, history, whether it be last night or 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago, they're opinionated, aren't they? They're subjective, because rowdy and disrespectful, I seem to recall in our mid-teens throwing things at the screen for the Rocky Horror Show, but possibly rowdy, but certainly not... certainly not disrespectful.
Disrespectful, no.
Although I do remember now, I do think now.
But do you not remember other audience people
telling
us off?
Yes. Because the thing is, you think you're so much more mature than you are at that age. We were pretty much little kids, man. Yeah. I mean, what were we?
14, 15.
Was that how young we were?
14 when we went to the Rocky Horror Picture Show at the Embassy as 14-year-olds, having discovered that audience participation album.
Yeah.
And then when we were 15...
Was it that early on?
Hoyts or like Mid-City started playing the film every Friday night. And when you used to go every Friday night and everybody was dressed up and yelling things, that made sense.
Yeah.
But I remember that time we went to the Embassy and it was...
I don't think we would have been that young. Would we have been going in fourth form? I would have thought it would be fifth or sixth form.
It was fourth form the first time.
But then when we really got into it, that would be fifth into sixth form.
Yeah.
Right? And I hope that our wider audience understands the cultural references in that film, because my grandmother randomly brought it up a few months ago, and she didn't speak of knowing much about the film, but she said, yeah, I seem to remember driving a bunch of you guys around in fishnets in my mini.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is kind of odd in itself. I don't know if I'd go anywhere in fishnets now.
No. I hate fancy dress parties. Like, that is anathema to me.
And I don't think, there was certainly, I can't speak for other members of our ragtag troupe, but there certainly was no sexual element to it for me.
No. It was just
And how we got that mid-city thing where they actually said we condone it and come along, I don't know if you remember, but somehow Hayden or someone, the theatre manager actually, we must have gone to one, and he invited us all along after school during the day and talked about us kind of being the permanent, do you not remember that? We've got to try and piece together, this is a very niche podcast, we're probably going to discuss a lot of stuff and try and piece stuff together that'll you'll most enjoy if you're at Lyle Bay School between 1982 and 1986, Evans Bay Intermediate between 1987 and 1988, and Wellington High between 89 and 93, and Victoria University between 94 and 96. Which is because, we've seen each other three or four times since the late 90s?
Maybe a few more than that.
A few more than that. In the scheme of things, only recently reacquainted, but we had an odd trajectory. Considering where we grew up, which is the eastern suburbs, Lyle Bay / Kilburnie, where it was kind of a given for most students, would you say, to go to either Rongotai or East?
Yeah.
Or so you and I, I turned up at Lyle Bay School in whatever it was, New Entrance.
Yep.
We went through that school, both never went
to
another school or whatever.
First day of school.
Right, we'll get there.
Yeah.
And then we both went to the same intermediate, which wasn't unusual because pretty much everyone in the eastern suburbs went to Ebus.
Wasn't that horrible?
Which is still... It looked 10,000 years old then, and it still looks 10,000. Yep. It looks like it's kind of a jail yard from the outside.
That was my experience of intermediate. It was like a giant prison for 11 and 12 year olds.
Really? You didn't like it?
No.
Why not?
I just thought those 2 years were awful.
The teaching or the school?
No, we were awful kids. We went through like seven teachers in Form 1.
I wasn't in your... We were separate in that regard there. I was in Community 1.
Then the deputy principal took over my class, and we became the class that all the trouble students got sent to.
Right.
So,
I guess it's the beginning of any... kid starting to push the boundaries a bit. Like, it's weird for you, because to me I'd say the most terrifying or the most terrible year for kids' behavior is I'd never teach fourth form or whatever it's called now. Seem to remember it's just a sea of hormones and pushing the boundaries. And so similar trajectories through there, theater, music, blah 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 blah, our drama, as it were, drama class. And then lo and behold, we both go to Vic Uni and do the theatre and film degree. So not only go to the same uni, but do the same major. So my first day at New Entrance.
I just remember you in a school assembly.
What, they paraded me in front of everyone?
I feel like they might have singled out new kids, and I would have gone, "Who's that?"
Yeah. Because I think I briefly went to Hokkaido, but very briefly.
Yeah, you didn't join like on a day when a whole bunch of new kids were starting school.
Yeah, and then my earliest memory of there is Judith Bird in Standard One,
yes,
who was one of those prolific and regular letter writers to the Evening Post back when people wrote.
Yeah.
Letters to the editor. She was actually probably one of the first activists I met.
Oh yeah.
Remember, she was all covered in badges and...
Yeah, yes. I wondered if Seven was too young to be having the intricacies of apartheid and the Springbok tour explained to you. She was a great teacher.
That's quite radical of her, considering that was 1983. And even though that had all passed and the right decision had been made, there would have been a lot of parents back then, if that had been taken home, who would have gone... What's she fucking telling you that about for?
Do you remember she banned Disney from the classroom? No. Because she said that Walt Disney was a, you know, was a collaborator with Adolf Hitler.
And, no, right, really?
Yeah, she would only allow Grimm's, you know, the original Grimm's, Brothers Grimm versions of fairy tales and things like that.
You know, what I find interesting is, yeah. I hope listeners can relate to this, because I think young memories are young memories, whatever. So we'll tell ours. And I think, all of this interests me because, you know, how schooling's changed and how attitudes of children's change. But so any memory I have today that you have a different view on, I'm really interested on, because also memory's completely manufactured as well, right? But my take on people like Judith Bird is, I don't know whether we were lucky or whether it was the hiring policy of the school, but we had her, who I remember being reasonably old as a teacher back then. Then we had Mr. Kelly, who must have been near retirement. Yeah. Then we had Ray Palliser, who was our principal. Now, my point to all of that is, they were from the era where they could have been quite awful human beings as teachers, but we actually had three really lovely people of that era who, although they brought that kind of sternness and that old school approach to schooling, they were good to us. They grew us as little humans.
Everybody was terrified of Mr. Kelly until you were actually taught by him and you realised that he was brilliant.
Yeah, that's standard four, and I actually can remember a reasonable amount of that year, considering it was 1986.
Yeah. And his ethics and morality, which I later realised were sort of quite at odds with who he actually was as a human being. You know, he was always staunchly, you never need to drink anything stronger than lemonade. And I think
I remember him saying that.
And I think he drank stuff that was a lot stronger than lemonade.
Oh, do you think he was an old boozer?
Well, certainly, was it lung cancer that finished him off?
Mr. Kelly?
Yeah.
I don't remember him being a smoker, but who knows, they probably all smoked back then. Mm. But then I remember Ray, you know, it's Ray, right? Ray Palliser. So the principal, again, like my memories of him, a kind of Sam the Eagle-esque, sort of almost sort of wing commander type fellow, visually. Yeah. But actually a really lovely kind of old commander of the school. Now, I'll tell you a story from then that even then was old-fashioned, that if I told my students now, they'd think I was kind of came through school in 1927. Is, do you remember him rolling out the portable record player and hit playing 45s and us doing folk dancing?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, isn't
that's insane.
What sort of lyrics were they?
We used to go to old people's homes and perform the dances.
I don't remember that.
Maybe you didn't do it. Maybe it was just me.
But I'd imagine there was some, you know, sort of, I'd imagine there was some terribly lyrics that wouldn't. Was there lyrics in those songs?
Some of them.
Was it do-si-do? And we had to cope with girl germs, because you had, you know, that was the whole, maybe that was part of, like, maybe it was learning how to interact. And I do remember a lot of do-si-do-ing, though, which seemed to involve elbows linked and going around in circles. I suppose they do the equivalent now, right? But
there was a pretty great primary school when you think about sort of the level of community integration there. I remember meeting kids that had gone to other schools and going, oh, you don't know the national anthem in Māori? Oh, that's...
Well, it's funny, we think in parallels. I was thinking today about things we'd chat about, and I obviously have no perspective on any of this then, and I wonder whether... because I don't even know if gentrification or words like that were even in the lexicon then, but it's fair to say we were in one of the less affluent suburbs of Wellington, right? But none of that occurs to you when you're a kid. If you're having a great childhood, right?
There was a time you came to Wellington about 5 years ago, and you and I did a walk around the old neighbourhood. And pointing out places where we both had totally different perspectives on what those places, like you, you opened my eyes to a lot of things I hadn't realised as a kid.
Like what?
About what went on in certain houses and in certain families and things.
It would be guesswork on my part. But, how would I know?
But you were totally right in terms of the street that I grew up on. The people that lived on that street either had been born, you know, or their grandparents had been born in the houses that they lived in, or they were families that couldn't really afford to buy anywhere else, which I think was probably our case.
Yeah, but then I wonder, the reason I mentioned like things like gentrification and the way it feels like we've got more of a class system than when we grew up, is I wonder whether, maybe that's rose-tinted glasses, I wonder whether a lot of Wellington was kind of on a similar level to what we were then, because I don't... But then again, once I got to uni and stuff, and I did start to meet people from different suburbs of Wellington, I didn't even know there was different levels of wealth and stuff till I ended up at a few houses, and I was like, This is a side of Wellington I've not. Mm. Is Lyle Bay and Kilburnie still strike me as fairly similar?
Yeah.
Similar now.
Oh yeah.
There's grass there now. I like how back then you could play on things like jungle gyms with solid concrete underneath you, and that was just fine and dandy. So what? So spent 2 hours on youth, but what? Yeah. Why did you feel Evans Bay Intermediate was a prison?
There are a couple of things I think about with that intermediate.
This is a little dark, but our principal jumped off the building a few years later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it off? Was it jumped off the building?
Oh, maybe that's a terrible urban myth.
No, he
jumped
know,
off something and took his life.
No, it was suicide. Yeah. I wasn't sure how. But yeah, I just, you know, because basically all the kids in that suburb all got sent. You basically went to Evans Bay Intermediate or you went to South Wellington, right?
I don't think any of us would have gone to South Wellington.
I'm saying like they were the two intermediates, basically, you know, and you went from a nice
state non secular intermediates, certainly.
Yeah.
I think Kilburnie School had Form 1 and 2. A few of them did. Haitaia School had Form 1 and 2.
Yeah. I just remember that savage trick they did where, you know, when at the end of Standard 4 when they went basically like list the four people you couldn't be separated from. And it was years later that I realised, oh my God, they deliberately found out who you didn't want to be separated from, so they forced you to make new friends.
But isn't that's not a bad thing.
No, that's not a bad thing, but I found that, suddenly, you're separated from all your friends. In my case, in classrooms where crazy things happened, you know, we had the kids that, you know, we had chair-throwing kids and smash the teacher's stereo kids. And
But then again, David, again, I wonder whether it's that era because I think, I feel like, I mean, I've talked about it with my parents' generation as well, where they're from a generation that's even more rough and ready. Like, things were just kind of more rough and ready back then. Like, I remember you'd see student A sniffing glue on the way to school, or you'd see like all this stuff that, as far as I mean, I don't have kids, or you know, I don't know what those schools are like now, but I'm just guessing that a lot of that, we're just, the world's just not as kind of grungy as it was back then, don't you think?
Yeah,
I mean, think about just how Wellington was. It was a different city, you know, don't you think?
Yeah, it's it was sort of
everyone's been carted around in big SUVs now and dropped to and fro and not walking to and fro. And
whereas we didn't run wild, but it was an era where kids were sort of able to, well, as you say, we could walk to and from school.
And then there was Wellington High, where I think that all the eastern suburbs kids were dumped off on either level 2 or level 4, and all the cool inner city kids whose parents were sort of artists and actors and filmmakers and so on all ended up on level 3. Am I imagining that?
No, I think that's a very accurate
That occurred to me about 15 or 20 years later.
Yeah.
I'm like, hey, we ended up in the sort of no man's land levels. Great school, though.
Fantastic school. A really great school for just going, oh, you're interested in this? Well, let's encourage you. You're not interested in that? Well, let's just make sure you don't distract other people from learning.
That reunion you and I went to where we only went to the day events because we were cheap.
Because we were of the generation that, like, would all come to Wellington for the weekend to wag the Wellington High School reunion.
Right, and so everyone else was 400 who was there, which is probably good that we didn't go to the meal and stuff because it wouldn't have been a lot to talk about in terms of shared school experiences, but those students we did see around, I thought they had an even more kind of relaxed attitude. It just seems like the school must have kind of gone from strength to strength in that regard. They seemed like quite little well balanced little humans to me. What do you think of that weekend? Had you been back in those halls?
I had, because for a long time I used to try and go back each year for the Wellington High School Shakespeare Society shows.
Right.
So, you know, like at the end of high school, I retained a lot of connection to the kids that continue to be involved in that. So for the first...
Okay, well, for me, it was like 20 whatever years has passed and I'm back in this building and it's really crazy.
I'd been back most years for the first 4 years after high school to see friends, and for the sort of the subsequent years after, you know, whenever the Wellington High School Shakespeare Society had a big anniversary, they would invite me to come back and I would give a speech going, oh, it's amazing to be back here and we didn't know it would last this long and blah blah blah. Yeah, so I was more familiar with the way that the building and the culture of the school had changed.
How do you think the culture of the school's changed? I heard it went through a rough period with a certain long-standing principal there who was there after us, and it might have got back on his feet again.
I don't know. I think I think there are two different perspectives. I think that the long-serving principal you're talking about came in with an agenda of, these are the good things about the school, I'm going to accentuate those things.
Yeah.
I believe the next person was basically brought in to do a chainsaw job and get the school back on track.
So you're saying that person A didn't necessarily do the job wrong, she just inherited... I don't get you, she inherited...
The school thrives best when it's focused on arts, drama, music, sort of alternative inner city lifestyle, and let's be much more progressive than other schools in terms of our approach and outlook.
And you're saying that she probably didn't follow that track.
I think she did. I think the next principal was brought in to go, oh God, we've even identified gender, haven't we? I think the next principal was brought in to go, we're gonna undo some of the more
But the next one, hang on, we're just talking absolute riddles now, because there's one that I am going to mention, because she was fantastic and she was there when I was there, is Pat McKelvey.
Yep, that's
who was on the stage when I was there, and I almost had it reminded me, because this other completely new person I'm introducing now was after the fact. I was like, oh my God, Pat McKelvey's almost like a Helen Clark kind of a figure to me, sitting up there, all sort of quite stoic, but you know, she's really lovely, and I had not much to do with her at school, but I thought she was a great... So I was talking about this other woman afterwards, and then you're saying another person came in after that.
Yeah.
And that's the one that's there now.
I think so, yes.
Okay, well, that was entirely confusing for everyone.
I'm sorry.
No, I think I contributed to that as well. Mm. So... Our band formed, and I wanted to bring that up because we didn't know that our bass player, who basically I think it was my doing that I made
what
us
was your
all
doing?
Somehow we all decided we wanted to play instruments. None of us could. I think I'd been taking guitar lessons with
the slowest
guitar teacher in the world.
You and I, do you remember? We'd both been doing those lessons
with Don King.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in 3 years, I learnt three chords and
every Saturday
and one scale, but also a whole bunch of Renaissance, a whole number of Renaissance tunes,
and learn how to play green sleeves, arpeggio,
basically.
Stuff like that. Yeah. But not the most kind of funky or rock driven stuff in the world.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we decided we were all going to get electric instruments,
you talked the rock shop into a deal.
Yeah, but I kept going back and forth, and I think we ended up with getting a deal at Kingsley Smith and so on. But I think no disrespect to the man's family if they happened to listen to this, which is probably highly unlikely. But Andrew's folks just seemed the least keen on the idea out of everyone. But who knew out of all of us that he was Jaco Pastorius, essentially? Yeah. Did you have any inkling of the man's talent back then?
No, my recollection was that you said, we're going to form a band. Andrew, you should be in our band. And Andrew said, oh, I don't play anything. And you went, oh, I'll buy a bass.
But I think that was because he used to go ba-doop, 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 ba-doop all the time.
Yeah.
And always kind of madly tap things out.
Mm.
Really? No, he must have had... Okay, so I just...
I mean, he had been taking music at school. Like, he'd been taking it as a specialist subject.
But by your suggestion there, are you saying that you think if it had been drums I'd suggested, he'd be Ginger Baker, he would have ended up being Ginger Baker? Do you think it was just whatever he picked up?
No, I think the bass was... I think the bass was his instrument.
I'm not taking credit for that because that's a fluke, but obviously, something struck a chord with him. And rest in peace. Terrible news.
Mm.
And then from there, I could not believe when I'd sort of hear through the grapevine what was happening for him next. Ended up composing. Ended up what else? High in the Wellington Jazz Society, teaching.
Yeah.
Did you catch up with him? So
I saw him a lot through. I mean, obviously he didn't go to university with us, but he went to jazz school. Yeah, he went to jazz school. In fact, he dropped out of high school to go to jazz school.
I don't remember that.
All right. Yeah. Start of seventh form, jazz school. Went. None of the bass players that auditioned are up to scratch. Do you want to come and take the bass position in this course?
But how would... Hang on. Back in these days with no kind of connection media-wise and stuff like we have these days, how had he gone from plunking out average Led Zeppelin covers
Do you know what I've just realised?
But how did they know that he'd be able to play?
Maybe he made that up. Maybe he actually auditioned and got in, but that what he told us in those first few weeks of high school.
Yeah. Oh, good on him. Because all he was playing was before that. So I don't know how you'd go from that to jazz school. But so a number of listeners would have...
I used to see him gig a lot through
I used to with
university.
Apollo 10.
Yeah, Apollo 10 and Delirium.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So, you know, a number of listeners will be familiar with Andrew and probably know that he passed away, which was shocking news. I think it was one of the first times you and I had communicated in years. Mm. I think maybe you found an email address for me somehow, or I found yours or something, and you told me the news. So had you seen him in those last few years beforehand?
Yeah, I'd seen him probably 2005. It was probably the last time I'd seen him. So I'd seen him a couple of years before he died.
Yeah.
And I always used to run into him on the street and he would be running madly somewhere, or you'd bump into him in an airport and he'd be like, I'm really late for a flight, and he'd be, you know, running through the airport with a double bass on his back.
Classic artistic sort of temperament. The sort of late stuff half hanging out of bag.
Yeah.
You know, and on the sort of mixed minds to talk about this, but I do think it's important because we do talk about mental health a lot more now, and I certainly don't think it was a thing any of us wasn't in the lexicon we're at school, was it?
No.
So do you remember him being having a sort of a bipolar edge to him, or being down, or I don't remember.
No,
I don't remember that at all.
No,
that's the bit that I really struggled with.
I remember some. This is grim to talk about. I remember some instances at teenage parties of him flipping out and overreacting, and like reacting in a very bad way to things without considering the consequences on all of us, you know. Yeah.
But isn't that just teenagers? Sounds like I'm sure there's stories like of me being like that.
I went to see his parents after after he died, and they just, you know, they were like, we just have no idea what went on. And sort of the way that they described the events, it almost sounded like he had one of those flip out overreactions and took it too far. But that's not to downplay the mental health issues.
Well, but you're not downplaying them at all. Yeah. We're discussing them, which is good, as I say. And I think you're describing a mental health issue that, as I say, while in the same breath, I completely, you know, I have serious issues with half the, you know, childhood population being medicated these days. At the same time, it sounds like maybe there was something there that wasn't picked up on.
Yeah.
But what, you know, what an incredible talent. Did you go, just to close this off, did you go to one of his musical colleagues organised his work to be played posthumously? Did you go to that?
To Mantis, no, I didn't. I've got the record.
Yeah.
I find it really hard to listen to.
Is it amazing technically?
Yeah. I know, I've crossed paths with a lot of musicians that have worked with him over the years, and and he's just a very hard guy now for anyone to talk about.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking now, as I all these memories flashing through my head, that it's a word that can often be hackneyed and bandied about, but perhaps he was some kind of genius, because I realised that when I saw the I don't know how I cottoned on to that project. Mm. I must have seen it online or something somewhere. But the way I heard his musical colleagues speak of him, it sounded like he was in a league of his own.
Yeah.
I mentioned names like Jaco or Ginger, all those. Seems like he was our New Zealand version thereof.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, what do you say? It's tragic. It's very sad. And I often think of him.
Yeah.
And I think it's... I think I've been very lucky in the scheme of things, that in terms of losing people very close to me, but I think Andrew's the person closest to me that I've lost in that regard. So yeah,
You know, we spent so many intense hours together as teenagers as well, and that's not that there's any age that is good to lose significant figures of your life. But thinking that intense teenage friendship,
the whole bunch of us?
Yeah, those friendships I feel run deeper than maybe the friends that you make in your 20s, 30s, and now even your 40s.
Well, I've read two things around that, it makes sense, you make increasingly less friends as you get older, because you're not whatever, you're not as gregarious, you're not around school, you're not as open as you once were, and so on and so forth. But yeah, there's also something about that period of time that is exactly what you described. You seem to form these enduring friendships. And I think it's related to things like, you know how a lot of people will they will perhaps stick to 5 albums from their teenage years.
Yeah.
If you're not into music in a big way like we are.
Yeah.
I think those sort of things are related. It's so funny how people like, a lot of adults, a lot of dreary adults are so down on teenagers, but I think it's such an open and experimental and like, you know, even people who end up very conservative are often at their most sort of open and liberal in those teenage years.
Yeah.
And it seems some people just go, don't know what that is. So to the Shakespeare thing, at school, you know, we were both doing drama, certainly. I don't remember our drama teachers having any particular bent for those traditional playwrights and so on. In fact, I think, if anything, what was the woman's name before Jo? Carrie pouring the vodka down the punk's throats at the birthday party. That's liberal Wellington High School for you.
Yes.
My parents would have been horrified. Oh. I seem to remember we had to just do a piece pretending to be anyone, and I cringe now even when I think about it. I did Rick from the Young Ones, and it was very... It would have been awful 15-year-old, hyperactive, smashing things, nonsense, probably. But anyway, I don't remember her or Joe, as I say, we didn't really do traditional theatre at school, although we were doing drama. So did the Shakespeare thing... Which is, if you look up a shortlist under the word Shakespeare in New Zealand, your name's going to come up.
Yeah.
did it come from Laurie, another teacher from Wellington High School, his enthusiasm for, was it him that set up the Shakespeare Society?
No, it was an entirely student set up thing.
Stephen Adams?
Stephen, who was the year ahead of us, was, I think, when we were fourth form, he was fifth form.
Yeah.
He was like the school's top English, science, history, economics, maths student. I think the rumor I heard was that he got like the top mark in the country for school cert English that year. The following year he went,
I got 86. Yeah. What'd you get? I bet you remember. I think I got 48 for maths and 86 for English.
Oh, I got 22 for maths. Yeah. I think my English was like 86 or 89 or something. But Stephen, to set himself, to basically in sixth form, he went, oh, I want to give myself a challenge since I'm the best at everything. So maybe I'll take drama for a laugh. And it turned out that he was this undiscovered prodigy in terms of acting and directing.
So, hey, those guys, where is he now? Is he living under a bridge?
Yeah, basically. I don't know if he's under a bridge, but he's disappeared off the face of the earth.
Right.
So he decided...
Maybe he's an alien.
He decided in the seventh form because, as you say, our school didn't do traditional drama. That was probably because we didn't have a functioning hall for the time that we were there. So we were one of those rare schools that didn't have a school concert or a school production.
Yeah. We had those things on level 3. We'd do school plays there.
Yeah. So basically the only way that you could be involved in...
With Lisa Burgess starring every year.
Yeah. The only reason...
She's in LA.
Yeah. I'm not going to... You know that Jo sold our grades to get her a better mark.
Sixth form, that was a weird system.
Anyway,
I was second in drama and I got like there's a range of 1 to 12 marks and I got a 16.
That's because
I'm exaggerating.
Bartered marks to get Louisa a better one.
So the Shakespeare Society.
Right, so Stephen.
Malcolm listens to these every week and I'm sure Malcolm's sense of humour is thus that he won't mind speaking of grades and so on. Somehow, speaking of Wellington, the high school's quite a loose approach to getting through the schooling system.
I always think of Malcolm.
Malcolm did fifth form and then sixth form and seventh form. That's what they were. Each year he was doing those papers. No one picked up on the fact that he wasn't passing each year.
Oh, no, you see, my recollection of that was the school went, hey, if keeping him here is the only way that Malcolm's band can enter RockQuest, then we'll find ways of keeping him here without him disrupting other people's learning.
Who knew the school was so supportive of Gap-Toothed Fish?
Shakespeare
Society.
Okay, Shakespeare Society. So... The only way that you could be involved in live drama performance at Wellington High was if you took sixth or seventh form drama.
Yeah.
There were loads of students that were really, really creatively, artistically talented when it came to acting, but couldn't take sixth or seventh form drama because it clashed with subjects like economics or English.
Yeah.
So Stephen and a couple of his friends set up the Shakespeare Society so that there would be a student-governed thing that would put on a production each year that you didn't have to be enrolled in drama to be involved in.
Yeah.
And they went, oh, to give it a novel angle, let's make it a Shakespeare Society.
Yeah.
And that was set up in our sixth form year. So I was in the first productions of Romeo and Juliet and Henry V. And then in the seventh form, I inherited the running of it.
And tell them what you did that year, David.
Well...
Is it a tad narcissistic in hindsight?
Yeah, God, it seemed... even at the time it was. Even at the time it was. Yeah. So what Stephen had done was Stephen had directed and played Henry V.
Oh, so you just followed suit.
So I sort of followed suit.
Richard the...
No, Macbeth.
Macbeth.
Yeah. And that was, and look, there is, why am I trying to defend this? There is a tradition.
Because I set it up so that you have to.
There is a tradition in Shakespeare performance. It's a 19th, 20th century tradition of actor directors, of an actor casts themselves in the lead role and directs all the actors around them. And, when I've had...
So you played Macbeth and directed Macbeth. Now, is that... is that no mean feat? So you have to sort of step out of the scene and then direct the scene, but you're central to a lot of the scene.
It's actually...
So you can give yourself notes in the shower.
Well, I'd say the counter to it is when I've worked on Shakespeare's where, for example, you maybe don't have the same vision for the play as the actor playing the title role.
Yeah.
That can be an enormous drain on the rehearsal process if you and your Prospero don't agree that that's how the play should work, or you and your Othello, or you and your King Lear, or your Hamlet. So I wonder if the tradition of sort of narcissistic actors directing themselves in those title roles is like, it's one less person you have to argue with. It's one less person.
Yeah, and I jest as I say, it's quite efficient giving yourself notes.
So
on the bus on the way home.
So I did that seventh form, and then I did that again a couple of years ago. So the year that I turned 40, and it was the theatre company's 15th birthday.
Your theatre company.
My theatre company's 15th birthday. There'd been this joke going around that that maybe I would direct and play Richard III for our 15th birthday. And it sort of went from being a joke to being a thing that we just talked about in all seriousness we were going to do, and we did.
So where did you actually get, because I could be wrong.
Right, you asked about where the Shakespeare passion came from.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because I don't remember, but my memory of, you know, we're still spending a lot of time together then. I don't remember you having any great sort of, it wasn't the works of Shakespeare, I don't remember featuring prominently with you. It was playing the character and getting the play together and so on and so forth. Have I got it completely wrong, and you already were building up quite a advanced understanding of the text you were presenting then?
I think, like, yeah, there are a couple of things. Do you remember...
What was theatre history at uni when you started?
Do you remember he says, trying to avoid saying remember when for the whole podcast? But do you remember the kids' drama group that we belonged to in the early 80s at Newtown Community Centre?
Yes, with the Cashmans.
Yeah, and do you remember the last show that you and I did with them was Midsummer Night's Dream, which we both tried to pull out of, and they wouldn't let us.
And they wanted me to be Puck, but I was obviously too ADD, so they gave it to one of their kids, which is fine. Because it was too big a character for me.
Because kids totally weren't ADD at all.
Anyway.
But if you remember, I just, like...
So you're saying you had an aversion to Shakespeare.
We did that when we were 11, and that was terrible.
Yeah.
And I wish they'd told us that play was meant to be a comedy, because I might have got on board with it a bit more.
Well, I played a talking wall, so I certainly was aware it was a comedy.
Okay, I wasn't.
Oh, I had a chink.
Like, this was this... But... Again, not wanting to get too grim, but you'll remember, and I think about this in terms of going, wow, you're the only friend that I have that might even remember my dad.
I wasn't going to mention it, David, okay, but yeah, right. Your father passed.
My dad died when we were 15.
And again, the way, who knows if kids talk about stuff now, but I remember you randomly, was it fifth? I thought it was third form. Was it fifth form? Yeah, you sort of dropped it as a last thing to say as you got off the bus to go home, and then yeah. I don't think we ever spoke of it again.
No. And
were you expecting it leading up? Or
No, it was okay. Very sudden. He just he died very suddenly one Monday morning of a heart attack when I was 15, and it would have been probably 4 days after your birthday.
Shocking, any time shocking, but yeah. As we just talked about, those really volatile teen years, terrible yeah. time for it to happen.
And at a point where my relationship with him was quite difficult as well. My parents had separated, and I was very, very angry with my dad.
I actually remember him well, mainly for all, it was him that used to drive us to and fro from the drama thing every week.
And the music classes and all of those things.
That was relating to Shakespeare, sorry, if I pushed you off track.
No. And I had, as you say, I would have just dropped it in conversation, getting off the bus. Oh, by the way, my dad died. And I remember doing that in class as well, horrifying people. Someone going, where's your assignment?
Yeah, you were kind of throwing it at people and then, yeah.
Yeah. then we had our, do you know what? It was the end of fourth form.
Because
fifth form year was awful when I think about it.
Yeah.
And then at the start of sixth form, I was sort of magically happy. And I think I basically just went through 18 months of going crazy and not sort of comprehending that all of that was tied to
your father,
tied to my dad,
grieving.
You remember how, as teenagers, we used to spend hours and hours on the phone, and everyone had call waiting so that you could go, sorry, I've got Hayden.
You know who the
line.
Most notorious? Let's give Malcolm another. Yeah. The most notorious was Brian, Malcolm's father, used to answer the phone. Malcolm's answering service.
Yeah, and in those nights when you used to spend hours and hours on the phone, I remember I was talking to Nikki, Nikki and I were talking about something, and she asked some question or made some statement, and I just spent the next 45 minutes talking about Dad dying, and it was the first time that I realized, oh my God, this crazy thing happened in the last year. And
so kids do talk. That's great to know.
Yeah, and I just haven't even dealt with it, and that's why my marks have been crappy, why I've been disinterested in doing schoolwork.
Well, you've got all these emotions you already have as a teenager, and confusion and so on, amplified.
You know, why I've been a shitty, weird friend, and why I've been flipping out at people. And
So it didn't get talked about around the house with your family?
Well, no, because you know what? You know what people are like with New Zealand men as well? It was like basically, you know, within sort of 10 minutes of being told your dad's died, a family member said, now you need to man up. You're the man of the family now. Don't cry. Don't show emotion. Don't let anyone know that you're hurt. Goodness. And so I just bottled it for, I don't want to say the rest of my life.
I was going to ask that as well, whether it was 15 years ago, 15 years later or something, that you suddenly go through it all properly? Are you saying it's still a thing now?
It's still a thing. Yeah. It's like one of the defining events of my life.
Yeah.
But the positive of it is it wasn't just that phone call. It wasn't just that phone conversation with Nikki. It was a night in fifth form when we were at Anna Gamlin's house in Karori, pretending that we weren't drinking. You were there that night.
But even if we were drinking, it would have been a bottle of wine between 18, 14-year-olds.
A bottle of fizzy wine between, And I remember being downstairs at her place, and we were all there, and everyone was having a great time, and I was going, I'm not feeling this. I wish I were anywhere other than surrounded by all these great people having a great time. And I went upstairs and sat in her room, and there was a copy of Hamlet sitting on her desk, because she was Shakespeare mad. She was Romeo and Juliet mad. Which is sort of different.
She was just mad.
Different to being into Shakespeare. And I sat there that night in her room while everybody else was partying, and I read Hamlet.
Yeah.
And I went, probably 2/3 of this I don't get, but the third that I get speaks to me on a level that mum, that my sisters, that guidance counsellor, teachers, friends, that no one else has been able to talk to me on. And that I don't want to, like, it would be vainglorious to say that unlocked Shakespeare for me. But
I think you've just described exactly that, and you've contextualized it really well.
But it unlocked an approach to Shakespeare, which is that I went, okay, this 400-year-old play is actually about someone that's just like me going through the same feelings that I am. And every Shakespeare play I've read, I've taught, I've directed, that I've looked at, I go, okay, what is the way in for here and now?
So are you saying that he had a knack for connecting with the human condition?
Absolutely.
That
yeah.
a number of, well, most other writers will never match. Yeah.
yeah.
So an understanding, and especially in about our era,
yeah.
in his era, how much would people have communicated this sort of thing to each other? So, quite a raw, honest
yeah.
individual for the time.
I think there's that is the way into Shakespeare. But then the other thing is that I've always been sort of quite obsessive, and I've been one of those sort of train spotters of give me a subject that has a lot of stuff about it. So I sort of go Shakespeare is in terms of, you know, like my musical interest.
Yeah.
I grew up loving the Beatles.
Yeah.
And I grew up loving the Beatles because I love the music, but
yeah.
also because I loved going, okay, there's 11 albums, there's yeah. 190 songs, there's like 10,000 books, there's all these documentaries and films.
Yeah. Like your Doctor Who obsession yeah, in your childhood.
That's exactly the same of going, okay.
David had a tiny little room with wall-to-wall Doctor Who books.
Yeah.
Presumably written based off the TV, like
yeah.
TV.
And again, going the Doctor Who thing is that there are 150 novels. There are loads of 700 episodes. There are the videotapes and the behind the scenes books. And Shakespeare is the same for me. Of going, it's this infinite thing where there are all these different strands of Shakespeare scholarship.
We can frame things two different
yeah.
ways. So you
yeah.
can say A, you're a long term collector, or B, you may be veering on being a hoarder. Do you still have all the Doctor Who books in a box somewhere?
I do not want to tell you how many boxes of books we freighted to Auckland
wow.
last week.
Have you got shelves to put them on?
Got some cases. I
yeah.
think basically the 70 odd boxes are all just going to sit in the spare room until I can deal with them.
So with Shakespeare, I'd imagine for a lot of people, this is going back into stories about teenage years that will relate back to our subject shortly. I've thought about my approach to the education system, and that's that, as I say, was I don't know if I was ADD. I don't know what I was, but it was something where as long as I was kept to doing something vaguely to keep me not being disruptive, I kind of slipped through the school system in a lot of ways, if that
yeah.
makes sense. And
yeah.
I think that carried on through... Don't worry, this is getting back to Shakespeare. Yeah. I think that carried on through to uni, whereby... And I think this is a really case, whatever personality you are, I'd be happy with my kids to take a few years off and then go to uni. I just sort of rode through it. I turned up to everything. I turned up to the tutes and stuff, but I didn't really engage with a number of the papers. So I remember doing the theatre history paper that quite heavily lent on Shakespeare with Dr. Carnegie. And I didn't apply myself enough to understand the work. I was obviously handing in essays that would get me a pass. But so my point being is, I think one of the first barriers for a lot of people is the language use. How do you attune like young people, people who maybe have an aversion to heavier literature in general? How do you explain the older language style? You see what I mean? I think it's a big barrier to entry point for a lot of people. Although you picked up Hamlet.
I think for me, the first point of understanding is through speaking it and performing it,
yeah.
And then hearing it.
Yeah.
So the theatrical adage is always that the audience might not understand everything you're saying, but you have to.
Yeah.
And the next step on from that is going, my responsibility is to try and communicate all of these things to the audience. I have an affinity with that language.
Yeah.
But
I'm saying, how do you pass on that passion to people as a teacher or whatever? You're saying it's through performance mainly.
but through being passionate about it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure with a lot of the people that I've taught over the years, they go, well, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about, but he seems really excited about it, and that's and that makes me excited.
So you're saying you've got a bunch of excited audience members who still have no idea what's going on. That doesn't sound... You know,
well, yeah.
Stephen Hawking is passionate and excited about stuff, and I don't understand a lot of what he's passionate and excited about.
I don't know. I think there is. I'm like really feeling that coffee kicking in now.
That's
so
good.
The brain is going much faster.
You can
than the mouth.
Curse me at 3 a.m. You with your theatre group. I did a quick read today, and I liked how you said it, sort of, because it's sort of tying in with what I said of like just whatever the theatre is, it being what you want to produce is got to be accessible for audiences. And I think you said something like, economically, intellectually, and do you remember the other one? Geographically. So, and I really like that. Mm. And I really thought it harked back to what we started off at the beginning. our environment we grew up in, in the modest suburb of Kilburnie Lyle Bay. It would make sense to make that sort of theatre coming from that background. How do you achieve that? How do you do that?
Well,
how do you stop it being the same Wellington Theatre crowd every time?
Well, I don't know if there is a way of stopping that, and that's sort of
they've got to come. They're your baseline,
and that's sort of the big problem with Wellington. Much as I love it, hence the move to Auckland that I never thought I'd undertake. But you
neither.
But you then go, Auckland is actually full of all the people that used to make Wellington Theatre awesome.
Well, what do you mean
20
then?
Years ago? I mean, I go...
Controversial!
Oh, no. There's no money to be made in Wellington Theatre.
Yeah.
There used to be.
Yeah.
In the 90s, you could do a co-op show at Bats, and, okay, you wouldn't come out with millions of dollars, but you could usually get a grant to cover your rehearsal costs.
Yeah.
And a profit share at the end would sort of be enough to have made it worth your time.
Is this because Wellington's like a lot of these environments and following that neoliberal model where there's no money for the arts? Is it something like that, or have I got that wrong?
Yeah, it's there's become less money for the arts.
Yeah.
Also, and this is sort of the same as university culture. There's nowhere to go in Wellington. Wellington's very big on emerging artists and supporting new young performers and playwrights.
You can stay in a blissful, if you can keep it blissful, you can stay in a holding pattern all your life. At that level of your career,
I spent my 20s building a company, building a repertoire of work, building a reputation. The year that I turned 30, won a bunch of Chapman Trips, which are the Wellington Theatre Awards.
Yeah.
I turned 30 in the bar at Bats Theatre going, I'm never doing a co-op show for no money at Bats Theatre ever again.
You're going, oh my God, I turned 20 in this bar 10 years ago.
And
that sort of...
and I had my 40th birthday in that bar going, it's 10 years on and there's been nowhere to go from the success
on you.
So
good on you. And you know what, in the defense of people who stay in those environments, it's about where you're at. This is so cheesy, I sound like Oprah or something, but if you're perfectly happy in that setup, then that's fine. But I get what you're saying. If you're increasingly becoming frustrated by something that used to be a real passion for you, and it's because of the circumstances that you're in, you've got to move on.
There's basically nowhere to go once you've achieved all the things that you can achieve as an emerging artist.
Because I wouldn't choose Auckland as a strong theatre city, but then I guess half the New Zealand population is here, so I guess there's a percentage of everything, right?
Well,
so have you been pleasantly surprised?
Well, that
because you never really came up here and did projects in your 20s.
I did a few things in my early 20s. I always enjoyed working up here because it was sort of so different to Wellington.
Yeah.
But I mean, with Pop Up Globe, that almost that almost 200,000 people.
That's
in the
amazing.
Last,
do you think a lot of them are tourists as well?
I think there's a percentage of out of towners, but a lot of it is. I think it's just that Auckland has got the population and economy to support large scale theatre projects.
Good.
Pop Up Globe has got no public funding, no government subsidy. It's all basically funded off people's, you know, people remortgaging their houses until
it's a business. It's for all intents and purposes. Yeah. It's a private business. Yeah. It's producing art, which is, that's amazing.
And that seems incredible to me that, said 90,000 people last season, 102 this season would come and support that work. Whereas in Wellington, you go, whoa, hooray, 1,000 people came and saw our show
over its
3 weeks.
Yeah.
So you get used to...
But hey, that's a population number thing as well.
Yeah.
Do you ever, you know, because if you have one of those days, you get up on the wrong side of the bed and you contemplate things the wrong way and you reflect the wrong way and so on. Mm. Do you ever, I sometimes go, maybe the sort of things that I've been interested in over the years, maybe I should have made the leap and gone to somewhere like LA or whatever earlier on. Have you ever sort of thought, oh, maybe I should have put back theatre, LA, theatre doesn't scream LA.
No.
Have you ever thought, oh, maybe I should have bloody relocated to London and stayed there?
I lived in the UK for
I'm
a couple
I'm not saying you should
no,
have. But.
I lived in the UK for a couple of years at the end of the 90s, and it was great, but I went, the sort of work that I'm interested in, the kind of things that I want to make, everyone is doing here.
Yeah.
At home.
That's right. Small fish, big pond.
At home, no one is making the kinds of things that I want to see and want to make. In the same way that, like, when I would come up to the original basement or the original silo and do shows late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
Like Sharon Duncan, who was one of the founders of the original basement, and you'd go, oh my God, why aren't you in Wellington, where there'd be loads of work to sustain you and you wouldn't have to be taking on a part-time job somewhere else to pay for this theatre that is just basically sucking up all of your money. And she said, no one else in Auckland is doing anything like this. In Wellington, there are lots of spaces like this. So there's maybe that sort of martyrish need to provide something that no one else to provide something that people aren't able to get otherwise.
Which is exactly what you guys are doing. Now, my earlier question was a little leading.
Oh no, but you asked earlier about the geographically and economically.
Oh, good.
What we got to with
how do you make it accessible? Yeah, yeah.
Well, with the Bacchanals, we have tried to tour a lot.
Yeah.
We used to each summer, you know, do small town tours where we'd play a different small town every night.
Just get an RSA or something, some sort of hall that's going.
Yeah.
And great.
Church halls, community centres, galleries for ten bucks to come along and see Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
We then tried doing free shows. So we did a Hamlet in 2006 that played spaces where basically all you had to do was go to the end of your street, maybe. We played Hamlet and Julius Caesar in St. Jude's Hall in Kilburnie, and audience was full of people whose kids we went to school with. And,
And I've noticed noticed in your casting as well, it's not always been just kind of good middle-class white folk. You've got a good mix of people in your plays. And so the early question was, I was actually a little leading because I was wanted to ask you about if you ever go, oh, maybe if this had happened, maybe if that had happened. You and I have, and through different periods of uni, you and I have a fairly direct link to what has now become the household names of Tyker and Jermaine.
Yeah.
Now, mine was through the Capping Review when they first met, and there were four principal male roles, and everyone else was chorus. There was myself, Jermaine, Clement, Tyker, and a guy called Brett.
Yeah.
And I remember a couple of the scenes with Jermaine and I and so on. It was basically said that we were all a good ensemble cast, and then I sort of went off and ended up. I ended up having a few problems in the theatre and film department. So I sort of went my own way and ended up doing film. And I sometimes think, man, if I just stuck with Jermaine and Tyker a little longer. But I mention all of that because you were doing some of the original stand-up comedy shows with them, weren't you?
Yeah.
You guys were the humor beasts.
So
at the end of all, when you answer all this, say, do you sometimes feel like, and I'm joking, but kind of not at the same time, oh, I missed that train?
I lit the humor beasts.
Yeah.
So I was their sort of technician, stage manager, designer, all in one thing.
Humor beast was Tyker and Jermaine, right?
Humor beasts was Tyker and Jermaine. But I was in, so after the Capping Review, the drama club's mid-year production that year,
I hope this podcast doesn't come across like I've got a lot of regret. I don't.
The Drama Club's mid-year production for 1995 was a show called Body Play the great Duncan Sarkis orchestrated, and he had about 30 people in it, and he divided us into groups that all had different different body image related topics, and this is like the intermediate who can't you be separated from thing. When
conspiracy.
When Duncan was assigning the groups, I just said, please don't put me in the all male group. And so he deliberately created an all-male group with all the people that had said, please don't put me in the all-male group, which was Taika, Jermaine, Brett McKenzie.
Why is that? You
Kerry
wanted to
Smith
hang out with the girls?
No, more just, I don't know. Like,
go on, come on.
No, like boys.
Why do boys do drama?
I grew up in a matriarchal family, grew up with sisters,
yeah,
aunts.
You did, actually.
And so on. So, I've never been that comfortable in sort of all male company.
Yeah.
And the worry was too that everyone was like, the all male group will all just sit around talking about penises, and that's what their rehearsal process will be.
Boobs, surely.
But it was actually really nice to have the five of us as this group where we were all with a strong maternal upbringing, all with difficult father issues to an extent. Probably not Brett, but the five of us really gelled, and the segment that we made in that show.
So the five was Taika, Brett, so Brett McKenzie, Taika Cohen, later Waititi, Jermaine, yourself, and some other person.
And Kerry Smith, who... I don't think you ever knew Kerry, but he's now married to our friend Hillary.
Right, cool.
Yeah, who has the same birthday as you.
Mm-hmm.
Facts and figures. so the five of us then turned our 15-minute segment of that show into an hour-long show that did the Comedy Festival at the Basement in Auckland, and then did a sellout season at Bats, and then we did a university orientation tour, and then we took that show to the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Yeah.
And... Humour Beasts, Flight of the Conchords, The Bacchanals. I like to think of all of those things as being offshoots from that original show.
Yeah, and just from that period we were all at theatre and film together at uni. Yeah.
And the core philosophy of the way that The Bacchanals approach work wasn't actually that different to the way that Humour Beasts and Flight of the Conchords and all those things originated. And also those guys were all in the first... Bacchanals show as well.
Yeah.
But
around that time, when you were still very much in the fold with them, did you think, was anyone aware, shit, this is becoming a thing with them? Or did they find that kind of ridiculous breakout fame much later?
Because
you got to remember, I didn't live in Wellington from 2000, so...
My recollection is, like, Taika was already famous before first year.
Why, how?
I remember people talking about, there's this guy called Taika.
Taika
at Onslow College, who's like a Greek god in human form.
So you're saying he's always destined, he's got that charisma.
Yeah.
So we were speaking about his dad. So I can't remember what he calls the character in the film, but I think his real father's nickname was something like Tigger or Tiger, Tigger. Mm. And so despite the fact that that's set in a rural setting, which is where his old band ended up, it's a bit of Wellington underworld history for you, Tiger's father was head of the Satan Slaves, which is that gang pad that was in Berhampore for years.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So he obviously he picked an interesting side of him to portray in the film, but through my father's sort of similarly dubious background, I saw a friend of his, like in living memory, the last year, and said, "Oh, did you know that that character in the film is based on Taika's father?" And he goes, blah, 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 and talked a whole lot about him. So yeah, he was despite how he's portrayed in the film, he was in his own world was a charismatic figure around Wellington, albeit in the underworld. So there you go. I wonder what his father thought of his role in that film.
I don't know.
It's an interesting one, eh?
I
think it's fun. It's not derogatory. It's quirky.
Mm.
It's quirky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think we've been very self-indulgent and just discussed a whole lot of private? I don't think we have. We've been very honest and warm and open and spoken from the heart.
Yeah, well, it's sort of hard to, I don't know, it's feel always when we catch up that it is like, two wizards sitting down to go, right.
But not like the wizard from Christchurch.
No, but like to have a...
Do you know, I interviewed him on the radio once, and I'd grown up thinking he was sort of a quirky, lovable character, like a lot of kind of, you know, people who hang out in the street and juggle things and yell are. He was a misogynist, old school, racist a-hole, and one of my very vivid memories of those years of interviewing a lot of people on the radio, just because I was so surprised by, and then sort of all, as I read about him years later and so on. So that's the wizard. So you never answered that. You never felt like, I wish I'd got a bit of that, cut off a bit of that pie.
No. I've always the last time that I toured with them in 2004. I sort of had this realization of I'm quite happy going off doing my own thing.
So am I. I don't want this to come this point. I was in jest, but the point I was making was more that fucking hell, these people we were very tight with in that quite small degree have gone on to do, you know, in terms of wider exposure, have gone on to, it's set a different precedent. I think it's probably tied up with the world's changed, you know, could you have done that in the early 90s and the 80s in New Zealand and stuff? No, but, you know, we're sort of more on the map now, aren't we?
Yeah.
And those guys are part of it. Is he still? Does he actually still live in Wellington?
Tyker.
Yeah.
No.
I managed to.
Oh no! I think he bought the house next door to his mum's.
Yeah.
To
store trinkets in. I managed to get hold of him and Jermaine privately through social media. Although Tyker, for obvious reasons, has disappeared off Facebook now. It's a fan page, and they did both speak to me. And I said, "Would you do the podcast?" Hey, because I'd love to chat to them, but also, hello, audience. But then he won New Zealander of the Year, and I got a text from my mum saying, well, he won't be doing your podcast now. I'm sure he still would if he was around, but how do you pin those sort of people down? What's your favourite project of his film-wise? Why did you say that you found Boy quite a challenging watch?
It's
sort of light-hearted...
I found seeing some of those childhood stories turned into I found it very cathartic.
I think it's a
lovely way of perhaps turning some crappy memories into.
So I think you just answered why he portrayed his dad the way he did.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I watched Two Cars One Night again recently because I showed it to students, and I thought, shit, you can really see the genesis of Boy in that. You remember, you've obviously seen that. Yeah. And now here I am marking 48 essays on a clip from What We Do in the Shadows before tomorrow afternoon. Yeah. Any closing thoughts, David? I feel like we could sit here for another 2 days, but your girlfriend would probably wonder where you were.
Or the cat.
Or the cat. Any closing thoughts?
Oh, I don't know. There's so much. There's so much.
Do you remember when Adrian Edmondson came to university?
I do. That was such...
Very random during the day.
That was such a great day. I remember... I always... everything ties back to Shakespeare for me. Not ties back to Shakespeare, but... In terms of the way that you manage an audience, if you remember, he'd walked off stage in Hamilton the night before we saw him.
Really?
Yeah. So
We
saw him during the day. Yeah. So he was doing a book tour.
Yeah.
But they'd put him on Pulp Comedy at Waikato the night before.
Ugh.
And let me say, the year after... I was at Waikato for orientation with Tyker and Jermaine and Kerry and Brett, and we were doing our show, and the mood at Waikato was very anti-Adrian Edmondson. Like, you know, the MC just had to mention, well, we're going to have a great night tonight, not like last year with Adrian Edmondson. But Adrian Edmondson was doing a book tour of New Zealand.
Yeah.
He'd been put on Pulp Comedy Night,
and
he walked on stage intending to read from his novel to like 1,000 drunk Waikato students wanting...
Toga party.
You know, and he walked off stage within a couple of minutes. So
did they think he'd go, hello, my name's Vivian?
Yeah. So if you remember, before we saw him in Wellington, the head of Vic Books or whoever came on stage to say, now, Mr. Edmondson is here to read from his book. He's a serious author. He's not here to answer questions about The Young Ones or Bottom or comic strip or do anything like that. So can you please all just sit there quietly? And
I think we did.
Yeah,
it was very civil.
But there was a group of guys that came in late, and this bunch of people that
God,
came
your
in
memory's
late.
Yeah. Sharp.
These guys came in late, and during the Q&A, when everybody was saying, you know, what was your inspiration for the book, and where did you think about this? This guy that had come in late and had missed the talk was like, Oi, Vivian! and his question was, in episode 6501 of The Young Ones, when you did this, blah, 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 blah. And Adrian Ibbinson said, what? And the guy went, in episode 6501, blah, 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 and repeated the question. And Adrian Ibbinson went, I'm sorry. And the guy asked the question again, and Ibbinson said, what's your point, motherfucker? And the whole room erupted. Yeah. But that was great in terms of, you know, it was such a tense moment of, oh my God, is he going to storm out? Yeah. Is he going to walk off the stage? Yeah. And he totally cut the guy down. But the very first thing that he did, the moment that the event was finished, and it was like, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Adrian Ibbinson, and we all applauded, he jumped off the stage, went straight to that guy and shook his hand and basically sort of said, I'm sorry that I scored that point off you.
It's all part of the game.
And that to me, that's like an amazing lesson in performance, because Shakespeare, in the form that I've always done it, where you're aware of your audience and talking directly to them, means that you're often in this position where you can score points off audience members in a way that might sort of seem cheap and even sort of nasty and abusive. So you've always got to find a way of making that audience connection a positive one.
So many art forms we could mention, you know, stage performance based. I went and saw a couple of local stand-ups as part of the comedy festival last week. Similar sort of thing. Someone just, because, you know, how are you ever going to win heckling when you've got when you're up against a man with a spotlight on him and a microphone? But said man with spotlight and microphone totally cut down this group of people that, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. And it was to the point where I was actually, people can't see what I'm doing, but it was like looking through the crack, like totally enthralled, but looking through the cracks in my fingers at how awkward this was getting. But it turned up, it was as you say, it was a wind-up for performance, and I actually saw him at the end kind of down with them, sort of, you know. As you say, it's all part of the sport. It's all part of the game. But interesting with Adrian Ibbinson, the things we don't know, like that link I sent you where all those hidden people and the young ones behind the couch and stuff. Anyway, you know, in this sea of information where I don't know about you, but me being, sounds similar with your obsession with things, you know, the internet is probably a healthy and very unhealthy tool for people like us. But so I've done a lot of reading about Adrian Ibbinson over the years, and he is, in one way or another, shall we say, the most, I don't know if difficult's the right word, he's the one who needs the most managing out of all of them. And so for whatever reason, there's been things like quite good documentaries done down the track about the young ones and so on. And there was a doco done about, that I watched, that I thought was quite well handled, about Rick Mayall's death, where he was the glaring omission. And he'd quote unquote politely declined, but he's got a history of doing that sort of thing.
The two of them had a horrible falling out for a while.
In fact, that was tragic what happened to Rick Mayall, right? Yeah. So bizarre. That huge, you know about the huge accident like a decade or so before he died.
Yeah.
And then the random kind of death, which might have been to do with the condition he was in. That was a strange thing to be into at the age of 8 or 9.
Sort
of overtly political,
you
dystopian,
and I were into some things
British
kids didn't know about.
There's the cartoonish element to the young ones that kids will just find that stuff funny. I didn't get a lot of those jokes.
I remember you and I in Standard 4 watched The Young Ones when no one else knew what it was. And
I think it's because through a relative I bought that book to school. So we had The Young Ones book.
You had The Young Ones book.
It's there. Same old copy.
I've got a copy of that as well.
And How to Be a Complete Bastard.
Yeah. And then when we were like 15, TVNZ repeated The Young Ones. And we watched all of these people seeing for the first time a show that you and I already sort of knew.
And
really,
Miles
really
Tilly
well.
Used to come to school and recite the lines and so on. Yeah.
But thinking that Adrian Ibbinson, that around the same time as we saw him talk, remember Duncan Saki's saying about stand-up comedy, something that I think I've always taken in terms of how you relate to an audience, where he went, I would love to see a stand-up comedian that gave the audience a hug instead of punching them in the face. And I think that's...
Well, who do you think does that now? No one?
But it's that thing of getting away from aggressive audience interaction and moving towards something that is, like, that's what I want all theatre to do, is for the audience to go out going, wow, I feel like I've been given a hug tonight, instead of...
being given the middle finger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Please tell me you... aware of Louis C.K. and you watch the show Louis. Do you like Louis?
I haven't.
Oh, okay. No, we've got to get you into that, because there's been this weird parallel where there's been stuff I just would have no idea how you've cottoned onto and I've cottoned onto, and we've turned up we've been watching the same thing. So in our closing sort of 5 minutes or so, what are you watching or listening to at the moment that's blowing your mind?
What am I? I'm listening to the new Mountain Goats album, sort of on repeat since it came out last Friday, and it's probably not my favourite Mountain Goats album by a long stretch, but I love that John Darnielle is an obsessive guy who goes, okay, I'm going to make a whole album about this thing that I'm obsessed about.
Yeah.
And like his previous album, I was never into 80s wrestling in the way that a lot of other kids around us were, but I appreciate an album about...
is the album about 80s wrestling?
Beat the Champ, his previous album, was all about 80s wrestlers.
Yeah.
Goths, the new album, is about goths and goth music, goth and new wave music.
I'm going to have to check this out. Is it a solo artist under that band name?
They are a proper band now, but for a long time the Mountain Goats was just John Darnielle and his guitar. He's had a regular bass player and drummer for a long, long time, and they've added a fourth member in the last few years who's a multi-instrumentalist.
So in this vast sea of media we live in, this onslaught of content, how did you discover the Mountain Goats?
I was in a strange girl's bedroom, and at 5 in the morning she went, I saw this band at Bodega and there are only 10 of us in the audience and they're awesome, and she played me a tape. And that was my introduction to the Mountain Goats.
So it sounds like it was a long time ago, David, or did she just have a cassette player inappropriate era?
It was a long time ago. Okay. You know, the first few times they came to New Zealand, they played gigs to no people, but those people went and told everyone.
And if you bumped into her again, she'd probably not even fucking remember the band, but there you go, she left you.
Hey,
with
the first time that I saw them live, we got up a big group and I did actually email her and invite her to since she was responsible for all of us being into the band, and she politely declined. What else?
For example, that was interesting. I thought that, you know, one of our, as I say, our once every few yearly conversations, well, that will change as you're living down the road now. I think I'm watching this reasonably mainstream sitcom or whatever, and we've both watched every episode of 30 Rock back to back.
Yeah.
Which I, again, when I started doing some reading, it made complete sense to me. Someone described it as a live-action Muppet show, which it kind of is.
And I had no idea how much the Muppets had influenced our lives. Like, it wasn't till you and I went to see the first of those new generation Muppets films a few years back.
You know what's so weird about those theatrical screenings? All these men in their 40s, probably women as well. But it's like going to see this family film. And my little cousin who was with us was kind of like, meh, I could take it or leave it.
Yeah.
You seemed quite emotionally affected after that screening.
I was very emotionally affected and realizing, okay, major part of my childhood, but also going, okay, the Muppets, that's why I've always been into banjo music. How weird.
I think that'd be a lovely place to end. And then, oh no, we can't. We'll just keep going. Because I watched the next one. I didn't think it was nearly as good.
No, but it had Tina Fey in it.
It had Tina Fey in it. It's such a shame you can't replicate those voices. But hey, Jim, Jim's gone.
Mm.
Thank you for coming in. I have no idea what we talked about. I'm always fascinated when I listen back.
Excellent.
Okay.